February 21st, Monday, and House Trade and Economic Committee meetings will come to order. We are going to have an informational meeting concerning the Governor's Small Business Council, chaired by Gary Caldwell, and also the Ron Fox from OECD. And also Wayne Embrace, Cascadia Partners. And who is going to begin first? Maybe Gary first?
Yes.
Yes. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming. Appreciate it. We will open a public that information meeting.
Thank you for having us here today. I am currently the chairman of the Governor's Small Business Council here in Oregon, and we put together a presentation based on some of the high points that we went through the state last year, and we'll get into that, where we were, who we visited with, and some of the issues that were brought up to us, not only from being small business owners, but from small business owners other than outside the committee. And it was a governor's statement recognizing that small business is the lifeblood of a healthy Oregon economy. Governor Kitzhaber created the Governor's Small Business Council by executive order in 1998. I've been a member since 2001. Governor's Small Business Council mission to improve, develop the growth and vitality of Oregon small businesses. Purpose to develop recommendations on best practices for promoting the growth and economic vitality of Oregon small business sector. Membership is small business owners, managers representing a diverse sectors and regions, and we are a very diverse group. Key and educational and economic development organizations from around the state. Members from Medford, Corvallis, Portland, too many Portlands. Culver, Joseph, Newport, Corvallis, another Portland, and Klamath Falls. And we try to bring in additional help. Again, we're not the experts here, but we are members of small business. We've got Bill Carter from the Oregon Small Business Development Centers, Central Coast EDA, Jerry Gardner from Oregon Department of Ag, Chuck Jones from the H Group also represents Small Business Alliance and the Portland Business Alliance in Portland, Oregon Small Business Development Centers. Maria Kissen is a small business administrator, Lydia from the Governor's Advocate Group, and J.L. Wilson from National Federation of Independent Businesses, and Marsha Rumer, again, from Portland Business Alliance. So we're trying to grab different people that, again, have a very broad reach into small businesses throughout Oregon. The definition of small business is a manufacturing business having 200 or fewer employees, or all other forms of business having 50 or fewer employees. So we think 200 is a bit high, actually. It's probably closer to 100 people or less to have a true small business. Small business accounts for 43.5% of the state's payroll. Small business generates 51.3% of state jobs, approximately $19 billion in small business payroll, contributed to over $1 billion in state revenue in 2004. 2002 state total revenue for personal income is $2.5 billion. So small businesses, again, the lifeblood of Oregon. Just a graph showing the different breakdowns as a percent of small businesses in Oregon. 6% have 1 to 4 employees. 9% is 5 to 9. 10% is 10 to 19. 14% is 20 to 49. 50 to 99 is 10%, and then 14, and it gets a little larger, but a majority of Oregon small businesses are all less than 250 or 200 people. Just the Oregon small businesses, again, this is the payroll. Which one is this?
I'm sorry, job. The payroll.
This one is
the jobs.
Okay. And the jobs as a percent of small businesses, very close to being the same.
And this is the one that represents that half the employment comes from the small businesses under.
So again, 51% of Oregon small businesses are less than 100 people. Our 2004 action plan was to provide the governor with a position statement on issues critical to small businesses, identify the importance of the issues from the members' perspective, and confirm these issues accurately reflected the views of Oregon small business. So again, we toured around Oregon, talked to a number of different groups in each location, and we should be able to get into that soon. We had 7 meetings in 2004, and we met in Portland, we met in Newport, we met in Salem, we met in Bend, and we met in Medford, going around. And at each location, we brought in the local OECD groups, as well as half a dozen local small business representatives, just telling us what their issues are, from workman's comp to health insurance to access to capital and some of the things that were of concern to them. The issues identified: health insurance. Health insurance and workman's comp are running away. My company, personally, last year our health insurance went up 15%. I have a difficult time passing health an increase of 15% along to a person buying my goods. What happens is we wind up eating more of that percentage, at the same time raising their individual costs and possibly adding a deductible, which we wind up doing yesterday in order to control. At our company, again, we're $25 million company. Over the last 4 years, my health insurance costs have gone up over $300,000. It's a lot of money. Access to critical resources, capital, human resources. We have 4 programs within OECD that help. We have a number of banks throughout the state that help. We have the U.S. Small Business Association that helps. But there's always a need for more capital when it comes to small businesses. Human resources, trained employees has become a bigger and bigger issue. Again, I can reflect on my company a bit. In January of last year, we had 84 people. This year, we have 115 people. I could hire another 10 people, but I'm not able to find the skills that I'm looking for welding and some computer skills and some different things that we're doing. We actually use the Oregon Lydia's group.
The Oregon Workforce Development Group, or the Employer Workforce Training Funds.
That worked great for us. We tapped them out, all 10 employees, within 2 weeks, and then they were dry. So it's. I think we need to spend some more time within the state doing training for human resources. Taxes are always an issue for small businesses. Marketing, transportation, and sustainability. We can get into each of these on the next slides. Insurance, again, as I mentioned, the cost and availability of health liability insurance is the top concern of small businesses. Expand the concept of using state insurance pool to businesses of up to 100 employees. I believe it's at 50 now. And oppose attempts to dissolve or convert SAFE. Everyone we heard from said only good things about SAFE, that it really worked for them, it helped keep their costs down. And that's a terrific program. Access to resources: ensure small businesses are adequately included in grant awards from the Employer Workforce Training Fund. Assure integration of small businesses, development centers, post-secondary education resources, and economic development assistance to support the need of Oregon small businesses. Again, training programs and funds, you know, in our position, you know, the people I'm hiring, it typically takes 6 months to train a new employee to come in and do that position, and it's difficult when you go through all that, or they may leave. In Portland, where I'm from, we had a lot of people looking for work from Freightliner, from Gunderson, high-paying union jobs, and they wanted to come to work, but I couldn't take the risk of hiring them to come in, paying them what they wanted, and then having them leave to 6 months to say, I just got called back to Freightliner, or, you know, difficult investment to make when you're trying to run a business and do that. It, you know, there's a cost to every company to bring in and train an employee to work and then have them leave. It's very expensive. Some of the people were showing us the other day that there's a cost of almost $7,000 an employee to bring them in, train them to do the job, and then have them leave. It gets to be very expensive. Access to capital. Small business contributes to a sound economy and job creation. Access to competitive required access to competitive capital. Advocate a public-private capital resources to finance potential development, growth, and expansion of small businesses. I think Oregon, again, the OECDD, maybe Ron, you could explain the four programs within OECDD to...
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to do that, Gary. My name is Ron Fox. I'm the manager of the Business Development Division for the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. And I'd like to introduce my counterpart, Victoria Pruitt, who is also with our department and actually oversees the small business activities as well as the business finance. But just briefly, the department operates through four principal small business finance programs, ranging from a very, very small entrepreneurial loan called our Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund. Maximum lending amount is $25,000. The business cannot be in business over more than 24 months, and their gross sales cannot exceed $100,000. But it does provide oftentimes that very initial funding to help a small entrepreneur or a person who's in business but has an opportunity to grow larger to get that financing. We operate two credit enhancement programs, one called the Capital Access, in which we actually provide funds to a bank that will make a loan to a small business that without additional credit support, that loan would not be made. So we deposit money in the bank's loan loss reserve, which then in turn allows them to make the loan and maintain their credit rating with their the Federal Reserve overseeing the bank. But the second credit enhancement is called credit enhancement, and we actually commit a reserve for a small business loan that a commercial bank would make in anticipation of potential failure, so that in this case the bank would not make this loan without enhanced credit support, and our funds are used for that. And of course, if the loan operates successfully, why our funds are never called upon, and then we reuse those funds again and again. And the fourth one is probably it's our major endeavor in small business financing. It's called the Oregon Business Development Fund. It's available for traded sector type small businesses. That means that they compete in a domestic or global market. They export their goods and services from Oregon. We currently make these loans in conjunction with commercial banking institutions. Our maximum loan is $500,000, and it's actually a secondary position to the bank's position. And usually in that scenario, usually is a small business is looking for, let's say, $2 million of additional capital to expand their business. The bank, based on their collateral and credit rating, will go as high as $1.5 million. Our program can come in, take a secondary position in conjunction with the bank, and provide that extra $500,000 of financing. We actually have a fifth program called Industrial Development Revenue Bonds. That's not frequently used, but it is available for manufacturing businesses, and it's actually it's a federally created program that allows us to participate in the issuance of tax exempt revenue bond programs. And we only do a few of those each biennium, but the Oregon Business Development Loan Fund is probably our most significant program in support of small business.
Okay, and before you go, could you give me what's the amount in the each this program, capital access program, and capital enhancement, and OBD, Oregon Business Development Fund, and how much do you have fund each of this program?
Chairman Lim, members of the committee, I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to give you that number off the top of my head. I'd be happy to come back. We're actually preparing a presentation for you that will cover those specifically. Just let me say that the Oregon Business Development Loan Fund, we currently have a maximum loan amount of $500,000. So we make loans of up to $500,000. In the case of the credit enhancement, I think those loans are actually smaller than that amount, the amount of exposure that we incur. And capital access is, again, a very small business loan, normally loans made by local commercial banks in support of small business. But we can provide you that additional information.
Okay. I do appreciate it. And if you could provide the total amount of funds available and where did you fund it in the last 5 to 10 years, so we can figure out what are they successful or did we lost any money, and I'd like to find out some information on it.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we will provide that information in our presentation.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Jim Stemmacher, committee staff. I just wanted to mention that in light of what Mr. Fox has said, they are preparing a presentation for you on their business finance programs. I think we will also be including the strategic investment program and enterprise zones in that presentation, which will be in a couple of weeks in this meeting.
The return on your
Representative Bellum?
Yes, when we see that report, I'd be interested in looking at the default rate after forbearance to see what kind of notion we have there.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Chairman Lim and Representative Bellum, yes, that's a part of the report that we are currently developing in response to the request from the committee. So we will have that information for you.
Okay. And before we go to the questions from Vice Chair Bruin, I'd like to recognize the Natalie, the daughter of Vice Chair. And we are glad to have you with us. Natalie, do you hear us?
Say thank you, Natalie.
Okay. Okay. Vice Chair Bruin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Also probably better for your presentation than right now, but I would also be interested to know how many businesses, especially small businesses, participate in these plans. Volumes, I mean, we're talking hundreds, are we talking dozens, are we talking less than that? And a follow-up to that, how rigorous is the application process for these various plans, i.e. how much red tape or not does a business have to go through to qualify for these plans? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and Vice Chairman Broom, we will provide you that information. I can just tell you that it's over the course of these four loan programs, there are hundreds and hundreds of small businesses who have participated, and we'll actually provide you with information oriented to a biennium of activity in each of those programs.
Great. Thank you.
All right.
Just real quick in that regards, I think, per our discussions last year with OECD, there has been a very minimal default rate. What we did calculate at the time is that there was, for every dollar loan, there was a $7 return to the state. So it is a very successful program, and I think Ron will be able to show that to you in the next week or so. Taxes, of course, are always an issue for small businesses. You know, again, you're paying. You've got a startup company. You're just starting to make money, and you're paying capital gains taxes in addition to a number of different things. If there could be some tax incentives to encourage businesses to start up and expand their businesses, is a lot of the issues. Support legislation to stimulate the economic growth of Oregon through a neutral tax revenue stream throughout the state. If there was a grace period for small businesses to help them through certain, in order to get over X hurdles, we think would be a big positive as well.
Marketing, international and domestic sales is essential to small businesses.
Mr. Chair, can I? I'm sorry, I just want to go back to your point about the grace period on the taxes. What do you mean by that? I mean, give me some more more flavor and definition of what a small business is looking for in that.
Well, that's what everybody's in exodus, actually. And what we did is identify the points. This year in 2005, we're going to identify solutions to those points. So I'm glad you asked that question, but at this point, I can't really give you any specific solutions.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Yes, follow up.
And I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but would tax deferral be among those things that you're looking at?
Sure.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Marketing access, I think, again, when you're a small business, and Oregon is a very international-driven marketplace as well, that having the ability to gain assistance through different marketing assistance, advising, technical assistance, I think Brand Oregon could go a long way to helping here, but the lack of funding within that program, the cost just to do a marketing plan with Brand Oregon is actually very expensive. But assistance to small businesses and the ability to develop market. I'd like to see more small businesses work with the International Trade Group under OECD. Again, we're in the different companies, but getting to them and marketing ideas and plans and things like that are taking up a lot of their time. Transportation, development, maintaining, enhancing Oregon's multimodal transportation system, near and dear to my heart. We all support Senate Bill 71, at least the concept of it, to invest into alternative multimodal infrastructure projects throughout the state. I think the bill needs a little help, but transportation and the cost of transportation within the state and moving product not only locally, domestically, nationally, but internationally is becoming more and more of a person's cost. And advocate a statewide plan to expand the capacity in excess of the regional airport. Again, it's easier to drive from Portland to Eugene than fly to Portland and Eugene, or in Medford for that point. I bought a ticket last year from Portland to Medford, I think cost me $550. Well, I could fly to Chicago for that as well. So I think most of us decided to drive down instead to do that. Sustainability is a big part that we're all emphasizing on as well, that people are concerned on. Work with the governor's sustainability leadership team in researching and identifying sustainable business practices. Again, you could be a sustainable company, but there's no credit for you to do that, and there's no disincentive for people not to be part of the sustainability plan. And one way or another, I think everybody is consciously trying to be part of that, but if either there was any incentive or a decentive for people to participate on that program, it would be something worthwhile. Legislative agenda for this year, again, insurance, support the SAFE program, support improved availability of bond liability insurance to encourage small businesses.
Awesome.
I did. That's my fault. That's fine. Small business contract and the regulations, review final recommendations from the advisory committee on rule streamlining. Advocate the implementation of those recommendations as a result of real benefits for Oregon small businesses.
Before you go to the next, could you give us an example? When you're talking about the streamlining, could you give us what could we streamline? We are talking about a lot, but sometimes it's very, very difficult to pinpoint.
Example that I may be going through, that I'm going through at my facility in Portland, I filled in an application to put in a mobile trailer on my facility for a company that wanted to come in and manage their operations at my place. Well, a year later, I still didn't have that permit. To be quite honest, I put the trailer in anyways, and it's been 4 years now, and no one's ever come knocking on my door. So I went through the process. I filled out the applications. I called them on a weekly basis, and it just wasn't getting done. and they wanted to move from their other location. And I just said, fine, time, let's get it done, do it on a Saturday, and we did it. It's a bit of a struggle just getting through the process. I'm looking at spanning another 15 acres. I've been working on my 80-acre site now for 15 years. While I haven't been down on this piece of soil, you know, it had rock, it had gravel. I just cleaned it up a little bit, mowed it, put some more rock down. Well, I found out I need to permit that. Well, I didn't do anything other than clean it up, but because I did not have equipment down there during the last 10 years, again, it became an issue of a permit. And I think it's some of those things where you want to expand your business. The complicating part of that is I have a conditional use permit where we are in the future going to be moving solid waste. Well, I've told them I'm not going to do that. I can do it up top, but I have to go through a conditional Rule 3 permit review. That could take up to 6 months. So my business is growing, and can I wait for 6 months to do that? Again, I kind of wait and did it anyways. So there are things like that that just prevent you from doing and hiring. And if I didn't do that, I wouldn't be able to hire 15 more people to come to work for me to get that business done. I wouldn't be able to move those extra exports for Oregon to help them get their business done. So there are just some delays and things, and I understand the rules. But there should be some kind of process where, you know, there's a reasonableness, what kind of hurry, like a passport. If I have an airline ticket, I can get my passport in 2 weeks. If I don't have an airline ticket, it takes me 3 months to get my passport. So I understand the rules. There just needs to be a better way of working together to get that done.
Okay, and for personal note, could you give us what you do and where you are located?
Not now.
No, I won't tell you where I'm located. I'm in Portland. I'm in the transportation industry. I run a short-haul rail service where I rail product with my rail cars that I buy from Gunderson out of Portland from my facility to my facility. And our business, due to the problems that the Port of Portland has, where they've lost two of their last three big steamship lines, my business went from 50,000 containers a year to 100,000 containers a year. Oregon exporters are going to move their product. Importers are going to move in. I went after that business very hard, and I'm moving it by rail and having it trucked on our highways, and that was the goal.
Okay. Representative Dallin?
When you speak of agility in permitting, when you're faced with that sort of decision, what is a reasonable amount of time? You're going to put 15 people to work. We're very interested in that. How long can you wait?
30 days.
30 days is reasonable.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not asking for it yesterday, but due to my lack of planning, I'm doing it to work with them to get it done. And typically, if I can, you know, we got notice from K-Line in November. I went for the permit in November, but still come, you know, December, January, I hadn't had anything yet, and it was time to move forward because they were ready to start moving 20,000 containers a year through my facility in the middle of December. So I think 30 days is reasonable.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Brune.
You know, just one quick follow-up question to that. Can I ask with your specific example who the permitting agencies were? Or was it City of Portland or was it various?
City of Portland.
Okay, thank you.
For 2005, we're having meetings again throughout the state. We've met twice in Salem this year just to get our presentation correct and lay out a game plan for 2005. We've got a meeting scheduled on March 9th in Portland, back to Salem on the 11th, in La Grande in July, in Coos Bay in September, and then back in Salem for November 9th. Our mission is we're to meet six times a year, every other month. We added the February meeting just due to some of the open session that we had on the 12th. We had a number of questions like yours is what are the actions that we can do about these, and part of this year we're going to work on what those actions are. We want to hear from you. We want to encourage everybody to review the report, which I think we've left with you as well as just a shorter version of what we heard again and what our mission are, and some of the different websites and accesses we have. It also includes, we're looking for recommendations, letter support to this plan as well. If we could get that would be appreciated.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
And Representative Buckley.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Chair. I just wanted to note on your comment on the desire for small businesses to be able to participate in insurance pools. It is possible for small businesses to join their Chamber of Commerce's and the Chamber to apply for insurance pool. In case that's not widely known, I think it's great to get the word out on that.
Thank you.
Representative Dallum.
Yes, when you talk about training, there were two mentions. One is trained and qualified employees. You mentioned welding and computers, and then you talked about teaching sustainability. Are those areas that our community college could be supported to our small business community? Do they have the capability from your perspective?
Chairman Lim and Representative Dallum, not to speak for any one particular community college, but I think the overall objective for Oregon's community college is to be sort of the first choice training resource for Oregon's businesses. I know that community colleges across the state do have special programs geared to technical skills such as welding and other metals fabrication skills. And do that, I think, very, very successfully. I just would expand a little bit on Gary's comments. The Employer Workforce Training Fund, which you will hear much more about Wednesday morning, Lita Culligan from the Governor's Workforce Advocate will speak to you about the coordinated effort that is currently underway to try to bring some training to the employment opportunities that exist in Oregon. But the Employer Workforce Training Fund, I think, is a very innovative move by the state to bring resources available to small businesses particularly, but all businesses really, that provides training assistance for businesses like Gary's that are that want to add employees but need employees that have those special skills required by their business. So I think it's a combination of both having the institutional capacity, i.e. the community colleges, available, but also providing the assistance to small businesses, because each small business has a bit of a unique application. I'm sure Gary's welders are not the same characteristics that may be hired by, say, Gunderson as an example. So there's always a little bit of fine-tuning to that, and I think the community colleges represent the state's they're 19 centers around the state, so obviously they have great resource availability.
I'd like to advocate for one more thing, too. I grew up high school in the Boston area, and technical high schools, I think, are a big positive. You're going to get a lot more. I think you'll improve high school graduation rate where you can take a welding class in high school. You know, and the way that program worked is half of your year was school, and half of your year was technical training. People, you know, there are a lot of people that don't want to go two more years after graduating from high school. So there was welding, there was home building, there was a lot of different technical skills that I think can be trained in the high school that, again, give you that high school diploma instead of having to go through high school knowing you don't want to go to two more years of school.
All right. Follow up. How does that relationship with the community college work? Is there a state provided meeting apparatus in place, or does a businessman have a place to go, and does the community college have a place to go that says these are the skills we need? How do they get together?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dallum. Let's see if I can do this. I'm going to try to do this from what I know to be the presentation that you'll see on Wednesday morning, so I apologize for doing this from memory. But in Oregon, we have a system built around WorkSource Oregon, which includes the Employment Department, includes the Economic Development Department, includes the community colleges and other workforce assistance providers. So a business in need of employees can go to one of these one-stop resource centers, and from that point, the access to the community college or to the employment department's inventory of available workers or to assistance from the economic development department to get through some of those other issues related to business expansion are served. So there is a system in place that coordinates that and provides sort of rather than a small business having to figure out, well, I have to go to this organization first and then on to this one and then on to the next one, that's all handled by this one-stop workforce resource that exists here in Oregon. And I know the presentation that Lita Culligan will give you on Wednesday morning, I unfortunately did not bring her presentation with me this morning to review with you, but it will be in detail and it will explain just exactly how companies like Gary's can make sort of one phone call and from that connection get both potential employees from the available workforce, but also get assistance in training those employees to meet the specific requirements that his business has in filling those positions.
Okay. And I have heard so many times our state has more small business than any other state. And could you explain why do we have more small businesses? And exactly when we're talking about more, how many more in the compared to the other state?
Mr. Chairman Lim, members of the committee, I think there was a federal study done a few years ago, and I'll have to refresh my memory to give you the actual citation for it, but I think on a per capita basis, Oregon has a predominance of small businesses. Now, I must keep in mind that the federal government uses a definition of small business that is 500 employees or less. And as Gary mentioned, here in Oregon, we have a definition of 200 or less employees for a manufacturing firm, 50 or less employees for all other types of small business. So when you look at Oregon, we are a state of many small businesses by that federal definition. I think another way to look at Oregon is that we do not have many very large businesses who constitute employers in excess of 500. So, and if I were to go, can I go back to my presentation? I think you'll see it in the numbers in terms of where employment comes from in Oregon, if you don't mind.
Yes, please.
Oops. Good luck.
Shake it.
I apologize. I'm sure there's a mechanical way to do this. I think this will give you some indication where Gary spoke earlier that if you were to use the federal government's definition, I think that's essentially 74% of Oregon's employers are of firms having less than 500 employees, and it's only 26% of our workforce that works for businesses of 500 employers or larger. I think here in Oregon, we just have a smaller percentage of firms that have 500 or more employees compared to a lot of other states. What I have seen from other states, our distribution within those other numbers is quite similar, but we have fewer very large firms that employ in excess of 500 employees in the state. I hope that kind of answers the question.
I think that is because of the agricultural business that Oregon is strong in also, which is just a lot of small farms that generate a lot of the income in the business throughout Oregon that just thrives on small business.
Thank you. So as I look at the chart, it looked like 46-47% payrolls comes from the small business, even though the percentage of a large business but more than 500 is 26%, but their payroll is more than 50% of our state. Am I correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I think you are correct. I think it's referred to in the council's report. If you look at the statistics for small business, their average wage is slightly lower per capita per employee than for the large businesses. So, and I'm going to change a slide here that I think will get me back. This is the payroll slide, so you can see that at 100 employees or less, they're providing slightly less than half of the total wage in the state, and the 500 plus employer category is producing 33% of the payroll versus 26% of the actual employment number.
So directions we are going to have in the future, do you think while we are retaining small business as it is, that the supporting more big companies like at least 200 more, do you think it's a prudent policy for us to support more big business because they are paying higher wages and they employ more people?
Chairman Lim, members of the committee, I would like Gary respond, but I guess my comment representing the state's economic interests would be to say yes to both of your questions. We need both the large firms who create a great deal of opportunities for small businesses. I think Gary, in his reflection, will tell you that a lot of his work is in support of large firms and so there's a lot of secondary benefits that accrue to Oregon by large employers who generally are in the category of the traded sector of the business. But at the same time, we need to support the continued growth and viability of our small business because the large business also depend upon those businesses for component supplies, other resources that are necessary for those large firms to be successful.
I agree. I think there's, my personal view is there's a lot of opportunity for large businesses in Oregon, pharmaceuticals, biotechnology, nanotechnology, that I know Senator Wyden's trying to drive up into Portland and in that area. Oregon, and just speaking from the transportation side of things, we have three exports for every import we bring into the state. And what that means is imports are coming up from California or they're coming down from Seattle and Tacoma. And one of the things that I'm making a presentation to the Land Use Committee at 1:30 is we need to try to attract importers, the Walmarts, the Targets, the Home Depots, to put their facilities in there so we have a matching up container for export to reduce their cost. But I think we need to strategically locate them where our exporters are. And I've been promoting Eugene or Boardman or the part of Morrow, Humatilla, Klamath Falls, where the exporters are, so that then we have a load out and a load back, and we can get into that at a later date. But we've created an inefficient transportation system with imports and exports throughout the state. But there are a lot of opportunities. The problem with distribution centers is they create jobs per acre, where in technology or bio, that create jobs per square foot. So where do you want to locate them? And I'm saying put them in a Troutdale, where the Port of Portland recently acquired 700 acres. Good location for them. But at the same time, if we could drive a Home Depot, which I understand there's a new Lowe's going down in Lebanon, very close to the exporters, if we can match that up, we save transportation dollars, we save wear and tear on our highway system. So there is a need to have both. And I think it's all a strategic idea of where do we want them as a state to go and be located to provide the greatest economic value to our state.
Thank you. And one of the nagging questions we are having is that our state is one of the hardest hit whenever we economic downturn in the nation. It is not once I have seen, and many times in the past, our state has been always in that way. And we are trying to figure out how could we prevent that happening in our state in the future, because it's going to come again, I don't know when, but it's always cyclical. And then if we depend on high-tech industry, and then sometimes when the bubble is broken, that we have a lot of unemployment. So, our state also known as the manufacturing sectors more higher than any other state, and the recession hits, then they lay off the people. And so we need to figure out how could we, our economy more stronger and more stable and sustainable. But that's a very crucial question. We need to have some answers on this. If you could have some thought on it and give us some light on it, we do appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I know that material that is currently being assembled for the department's presentation to Ways and Means does speak to some of those factors that you just mentioned. And I know, just again recalling from memory, Oregon, I think, ranks number two only to the state of Indiana as in terms of the percent of the state's gross domestic product that is produced by the manufacturing sector, as opposed to all other sectors of the economy. And if you look further at Oregon's manufacturing, we have a heavy concentration of what we called capital goods manufacturing, and electronic components would fall in that category. So that when you have a downturn in the capital investment by a global marketplace, as we had in the period of 2000 to 2003, the multiplier effect of that on Oregon is quite severe. I know from some information that Tom Petalski, the state's revenue economist, Oregon's portion of the state's gross state product in the area of electronic components went from something just under 2% in 1991 to something over 36% by the year 2001. In a 10-year period, the state's economy, in terms of its focus on manufacturing electronic components, shifted that much. And so when you had a downturn in that investment economy, why the impact here was significant. I should also say that in looking deeper into that, Tom's report also indicates that the firms that operated in the electronic component business here in Oregon actually did better than their counterparts across the United States. But the overall decline in capital goods investment, the capital budgets of major corporations and so on, plummeted in that period of time. So that's some of that implication that's associated with what happens to Oregon's economy when you have a decline in capital goods purchases.
Okay, so Victoria, you have something to share with us this morning?
Chairman Lynn, one of the things I'd like to offer in support of Gary and Ron's comments.
Just state your name first.
Oh, I'm sorry. Victoria Pruitt. I'm with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, Marketing Development Manager. A couple things in support of what Ron and Gary have offered. In regard to support of large business versus small business and bringing employers who'd have more than 500 employees, one of the points that Ron made was that big business supports small business. As an example, Freightliner employs over 200 consultants and subcontractors. Intel, it's over 4,000. So there are small businesses being supported by those larger businesses. But we also recognize that the next Nike could be in somebody's car. I mean, it started out of the trunk of a vehicle 20-plus years ago. So homegrown businesses here are very important to the state, and we look to everything we can do to support those.
Okay. Thank you. All right. Are you done?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming and the presentation. Well, I want to thank you and appreciate very much.
Well, thank you all very much for listening to us. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Next. Wayne Embry, Cascadia Partners. Please, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Lynn. We're going to see how little technology works here. Mr. Chairman, I wanted to just give you a brief introduction. When we had the Oregon Investment Council people from the state treasurer, we saw that the state officials who are responsible for overseeing investment of money in businesses are really quite far removed from the actual investment decisions regarding those businesses. So this is why one of the reasons why we invited Mr. Embry to talk a little bit more about the specific considerations that go into investing. I believe Mr. Embry has some background in investing public monies in private businesses as well.
Okay. Is he going to use the screen also?
I think he's going to try to use that.
Chairman, members of the committee and staff, my name is Wayne Embry. I'm the managing partner of Cascadia Partners, an early stage venture capital firm that's based in Portland. And thank you for inviting me to speak with you today. I just wanted to do a bit of an overview based on a prior conversation with Mr. Stonebridge, and more than happy to field questions in real time as they come up. Just as a way, a little bit of background, Cascadia Partners, the principals involved have been investing in early stage companies for the last 18 years in Oregon and throughout the Northwest. Now, we've invested in over 80 companies. More than half of those companies had their origins in research institutions and corporate labs. And as you can see, we've been reasonably successful. We were the lead investors in companies that are now ABI Biopharma, FEI, Sapient Health Network, which is now part of WebMD, Redisys, Full Sail Brewing, and Creative Multimedia, among others. All of those companies there were investments made with what was then called the Oregon Resource and Technology Development Corporation, which was created by the Assembly, actually this committee, in 1985 to invest lottery money into early-stage companies that were not really attracting the attention of the existing venture capital infrastructure in the state. And that program has evolved and is now really constituted by the Oregon Growth Account, which resides inside the Treasury. To give you a snapshot of small business, and what we're going to do then is narrow it down to the kinds of firms that the venture capital funds invest in. On an annual basis, there's about 600,000 new business starts every year. Angel investors, individuals with high net worth, that invest in emerging companies or existing companies, invested at about 42,000 companies in 2003. Institutional venture capital firms like ours invested in about 200 new companies last year, and that's a fairly consistent number over the last several years. About 400 to 700 new companies originate from the country's research universities and hospitals on an annual basis. In Oregon, we had about 13,000 new companies start last year and about 13,000 failed last year. We all continue to hear the statistic that about 90% of all companies fail in the first 4 years. The reality is of companies that make things, that manufacture, that produce software, that engage in actually building products as opposed to being in the service industry, about 75% of those companies are still in existence after 4 years. And, in fact, companies that are capitalized with at least $50,000 are much more likely to survive than their counterparts that bootstrap. In reality, the most common form of financing for companies in the United States is the Visa card, MasterCard, and American Express. In terms of getting companies up and running off the ground, about 75% of all companies are funded exclusively by their founders, their families, and their friends. Angels, as I said, about 42,000 companies, about 7% receive money from someone external to the business that's not part of the family. Another entity that actually contributes dramatically to investment in early stage companies is the federal government Small Business Innovation and Research Program, which is a program that began in the early 80s, is under fire right now. But the 13 largest federal agencies with research budgets in excess of $100 million. We're required by law to commit about 3% of those budgets or more, depending on the case, to early-stage companies. And it's been instrumental in getting a number of companies launched in terms of product development and getting those products ready for the marketplace. And then the venture capital community. Taking a minute to describe.
Could you explain to me, or maybe to us, what's the angels?
Angels? I'm sorry, Chairman Lim?
What's the angels?
Angels.
Angels.
Oh, angels. Angels are individuals. In many cases, they are people who started their own companies and were successful, became wealthy, and then want to invest in entrepreneurs that they've come to know and help them grow their businesses as well. So in addition to providing early stage capital, they provide business assistance, mentoring skills, connections with hopefully customers and other larger later investors who can help the business grow.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
And Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, could you just, maybe this is more philosophical than anything else, but when I look at these statistics and see that such a small percentage of businesses are funded by angels or venture capitalists, can you explain to me, in terms of a capital gains tax reduction, why that is the best incentive for development of small businesses as compared to another incentive that might go towards the founders, families, and friends that are the larger portion?
Chairman Lim, Representative Buckley, in most cases, if the companies are structured correctly, the family founders and friends will get the capital gains advantages as well. And so it's one of those things that we always tell people, it's like the old Fram Auto commercial. And if you make mistakes early on in a company, they're in a compound. And so we always advise people to get good legal advice, get good accounting advice, because those kinds of relationships, those investments that are made by individuals in their own companies as well as their family and friends, will be able to take advantage of capital gains consideration as well as for other institutional investors.
One follow-up, please.
One follow-up.
Has there been any sort of research done in terms of companies that are founded by a small group, founders, families, and friends, using money that they receive back in capital gains, do they reinvest it back in their company? Do they create jobs with that money? Are there places you can point me to find more information?
Chairman Lim, Representative Buckley, that's a great question, and I don't know the answer to that. I'll take a look and see if I can find something and get it to you.
Great, thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. And when you stopped the presentation, you gave us the information, 13,000 new companies started and 13,000 failed. So it looks like a wash. And what's the reason they are failing? What companies are they?
Chairman Lim, in many cases, I think the statistics, the current statistics are indicative of the general condition of the Oregon economy, that it is still relatively flat compared to other parts of the country. And I think a lot of those companies that are failing are primarily in service sectors, restaurants, dry cleaners, other kinds of businesses that are more service oriented and very dependent on cash flow from day one, as opposed to manufacturing companies which may have gotten some capital infusion either initially from the founders or even from customers to begin operations. So in terms of delving very deeply, the vast majority of businesses fail for management reasons. The inability of the founders and the management team to cope with the changes that they see in their enterprise.
Right. Thank you.
You're welcome. From the perspective of an organization like ours looking at emerging companies, more or less divide them up into these categories. The seed stage is really at the beginning, the idea, and the founders, the inventors are trying to build a prototype, prepare a business plan, get the business actually ready to launch. The startup, also often called the first round of financing, the company is launched. You may begin manufacturing at that point and have limited sales to initial customers. Second round financing is really additional capital to meet market demand, and in the case of life science biotech companies, to fund further our research and development. And at the mezzanine stage, this is usually the final private equity that goes into a company before it issues shares publicly through an initial public offering or is acquired, or creates the foundation for that company to acquire other companies to grow. And for funding, just go into a little more detail what we've been discussing. Again, the seed stage, historically, the three Fs, the family, friends, and founders, the angel investors, and in some cases, venture capital funds. In our case, we've always been an investor at the very beginning in companies. We don't usually make our initial investment in a company that's been in existence for a long time. Startup funding, again, it's generally venture capitalists at this point and angels. In some cases, strategic investors, such as customers, will invest in companies at this stage. Growth stage, venture capital is still customers, and at this point the banks will begin to enter the equation. Companies can demonstrate profitability, or in the case they've been well financed, they'll be able to get credit lines, equipment lines, and those kinds of things. And then larger expansion is funded by the public markets and large private equity firms, such as the Texas Pacific Group, Carlyle Group, and things like that. So what do investors, equity investors, want in exchange for investing in these in early stage companies? Generally, they're seeking at least 5 to 10 times their money back. We're also seeking sufficient legal control, if not financial control, to make management changes and strategic changes in the companies. And looking for companies that can grow rapidly enough to make those returns in a 3 to 7 year time frame. And the reasons for that is that most of the investment funds like ours are structured around a specific time period. So we have to get our capital back to our investors within that time period, or we're in violation of our agreements with them. So when we make investments in these companies, what are we looking for? And I kind of boil it down to 5 M's. The first is management. What's the strength and the characteristics of the management team and their ability to grow a business and be successful? Magic. We're looking for something that's unique, proprietary, that's remarkable about that particular business. It doesn't necessarily have to be something that's patented or patentable. An example I like to use is Full Sail Brewing. It's not hard to make good beer. It's hard to sell good beer. And the original founders of that company understood that, and actually understood the market better than most of their contemporaries when they started that company in the mid-80s. The markets look for big and rapidly growing or rapidly changing markets. A good example of this is in the late 1960s when the steel mini mills came into existence. They found an opportunity in the marketplace for small, very rapidly responding companies offering steel to large suppliers with small factories. And they worked incredibly successful for that. But I can almost guarantee you that very few venture capitalists would find that an attractive investment. It's like, who'd want to invest in the steel business? And you had people who understood their market and understood the dynamics of that marketplace. We also fund against milestones. What can the company achieve in the next 6, 12, or 18 months? And how much money is it going to require? And fund against those milestones as opposed to giving them large amounts of money to just spend at will. And then finally, the money. Does the amount that's going to be invested in the business justify the risk that's going to be taken and offer sufficient reward to meet the requirements that the investors have to satisfy their investors? From the perspective of the venture capital funds themselves, we raise our money from pension funds, large trusts and endowments, high net worth individuals, from insurance companies, and from strategic investors. So there are firms that are very narrowly focused in specific industrial areas, and those firms will invest in venture capital funds to get early access to technology and market opportunities. As I was mentioning, the structure of these entities, their partnerships, generally 7 to 10 years in length. We receive a management fee in exchange for managing the money and making the investments and working with the companies. The investors generally get all their money back first, and then after return of capital, profits are generally shared on an 80-20 split, 80% going to the investors, 20% going to the managers. To give you an idea of what's been going on in the venture capital marketplace, this represents all venture capital, so from early stage all the way to the late stage private equity. And you can see from the early 1980s until the mid-1990s, it was relatively flat. And then the growth of the internet bubble began in the mid to late 90s, spiked very quickly, and then dropped off. Oregon is actually in relatively good position on a basis compared to the United States. We've averaged about 1% of all venture capital in the U.S. in Oregon over this time period. But what happened is we fell off earlier with respect to going into the internet bubble and dropped further and have not really. And this shows some recovery, but that is really based on fairly large amounts of money going into relatively few firms. Something else that's going on in the private equity business, the institutional investors are once again putting more money into fewer funds. And the effect this has is that as the venture capital funds grow in size, it's harder for them to put money into small companies. So from the perspective of making seed stage investments, when you make an initial investment in an emerging company, those investments are commonly, $500,000 or less. And then they grow as the company grows and the requirement for capital. If a firm is managing too much money, it's very difficult for them to make a small investment. And so as the venture funds have grown in size, it's been hard for them to participate in that part of the market. And we see that by this this slide and the data looking just at seed investment in the U.S. as a percentage of all venture capital funding. In 1980, 40% of all venture capital was classified as seed investments, so going to brand new startup companies. By 1990, that had dropped to 25%, and then throughout the bubble, you can see that it continued to decline precipitously. Till last year, it was about 2% of total capital was being invested as seed or startup funding. And if you look at all seed, startup, and early stage funding combined, the bottom line there, compared to all expansion and later stage funding, you can see that there's been about a 9-year slide in capital available for early stage companies in North America. So it's created a real problem from the perspective of where do these companies get founded, how are they going to get funded, and then how do they grow and become attractive to later stage investors. And finally, from the perspective of and I'm sure this is probably something that the folks from the Treasury and Investment Council shared with you. From the perspective of large asset managers such as OPERF, it's very difficult to make small investments in small funds. So this is all a hypothetical example, but let's say you have a $25 billion pension fund that has 1% of their assets allocated to venture capital. So that'd be roughly $250 million. Most of these entities have minimum investment sizes. 20 to 50 million is common. Most of them have maximum ownership requirements. In many cases, 20% of a fund is the maximum that they'll invest in any one given fund. So that means the minimum size of a capital pool that they'll invest in is $175 to $200 million. It's very hard for those kinds of funds to make true early stage investments. And so, consequently, this has created a capital gap in the country that a lot of us are wondering how this is going to get solved. So that's the end of my prepared remarks, and happy to answer any other questions that you might have.
Okay. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, a personal thanks for any support you gave to Full Sail and Amber Ale. But to follow on that, if the Full Sail company was starting up today, from your remarks here, they would not have access to the same kind of capital they had in the mid-80s. Is that correct?
Chairman Lim, Representative Buckley, it's Well, they probably wouldn't have access to it for a variety of reasons. And the main one being that that market is saturated. But if we look at it from the perspective of the opportunity, I believe that there are a number of people around. They would probably have been able to find money from high net worth individuals. In fact, outside of our organization, the other investors were all high net worth individuals.
One follow-up, please. You said in your presentation that a lot of us are trying to figure out how to address the situation in terms of capital. Do you have any preliminary suggestions or thoughts?
Chairman Lim, Representative Buckley, one of the things that we've looked at is how a number of the pension funds, for example, could pool smaller amounts of capital that still represent a meaningful investment for them into entities which would then invest in smaller funds. The Investment Council took that step, I think, through the investment of $100 million in the Credit Suisse First Boston to address some of the issues in Oregon by putting money into the hands of managers who are at least inclined to invest in Oregon, we hope.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Dallam, did you have any question?
No, my question was answered.
Any other questions? Not? Well, it was a very informational presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairman Lin.
Right, and if there's no other business, then the meeting is adjourned until Wednesday, 8:30.
And on Wednesday, we will hear.